Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I do have to warn you that the cat has decided to be friendly because I'm using my laptop.
Yes, well, I just had Herschel crying at the door and I just had to let him in and let him out. So there may be some meows. Is that Felix?
Yes, it's Felix and he's molting, so he wants to be scratched.
Oh, okay, yes. As opposed to Herschel yesterday, who decided to play with a brown snake and didn't get bitten. Yes, we just wondered, where's Herschel gone? He's been out for a while. Oh, yeah, we just found him out the front, ready to pounce on a brown snake. So after much flailing and of limbs and yelling and whatever, we got Herschel back inside. Yes. Anyways.
Okay, so will we do this thing?
Yeah, we better do this thing. So I better introduce you and stop talking about animals.
Okay.
So, yes, you're my third guest on Looking Inside Speech Pathology. So I thought I would talk to a friend of mine that this is probably the first person I haven't directly worked with. I haven't really directly worked with you, have I, Tricia?
No, not at all.
But I did my PhD through Sydney Uni and Tricia McCabe is now – what's your title there now? You had a promotion recently.
Yes, Head of Discipline.
Head of Discipline at Sydney Uni for – is it called speech pathology?
It is.
There you go. Funny about that.
We're not saying speech language pathology.
Oh, or communication sciences or language and hearing and whatever, yeah.
No.
All the things we call ourselves. So I met Tricia, I don't know, gosh, it's probably about 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
Yeah, a bit over that, when I was going up to Sydney and we sort of hit it off a bit and we've got some mutual interests professionally and personally, which we've just been talking about cats for the last 10 minutes. So are you Professor Tricia McCabe?
No. Associate Professor.
Associate Professor Tricia McCabe works at Sydney University and has been there for a long time.
And I have.
Has varied clinical and research interests. You're mostly paediatric sort of minded in terms of, no?
I would say I'm mostly speech minded.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not age dependent.
Right. Across the lifespan.
Across the lifespan.
Speech. But I think you have a particular interest in dyspraxia.
I do. Or as we say these days, childhood apraxia of speech.
If you're talking about in kiddies, yes, CAS. And you've done some work in voice.
I have.
And articulation.
And evidence-based practice and service delivery.
So she's another one of these leaders in Australian or probably international speech pathology, really, that has a lot of skill and knowledge in a lot of areas, but they're all kind of related.
Yeah, I guess they're related, but I think we should be the best that we can be as a profession.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of drives the why do we do it that way question. It's always why do we do it that way?
Mm. Yeah, it's a very good question.
Yeah, and surely there's got to be an easier way to do it.
Yeah. I think that often then I think surely you would have found it out by now, but not necessarily so.
No, not necessarily so.
Mm. One of the reasons I wanted to interview you today is because of particularly your research in the area of intervention for speech, particularly in the area of dyspraxia, because it is, as a clinician, as a past academic and a born-again clinician, it is, I work with adults obviously, but it is one of those areas that it's hard to tackle sometimes.
It's hard to tackle clinically. It's also hard to tackle research-wise.
Yeah, and even theoretically, I think we're still not really sure what we're dealing with.
But I had an argument with a very senior, almost as senior as you can get researcher in speech pathology, naming no names or pack drill, who was saying, but we don't know what it is. And I was saying, but that doesn't mean we don't have patients who need treatment.
Yeah, they've still got it.
We fiddle about trying to make better diagnoses and definitions, the less treatment they get. And the worse the treatment that they do get is. So that's sort of driving that research agenda is I'm not prepared to sit and wait and have patients, you know, little kids be unintelligible when they grow up.
Mm.
Because we didn't have a definition.
Mm. So let's get straight into the guts of dyspraxia then, seeing we're heading towards that discussion. I can ask you about your childhood years later if we get around to it. But so it's an interesting topic because on one hand you'd think we do need to understand what it is to... Some people would say you need to have a good understanding of what it is in order to develop an effective treatment. But then again, you could say if you just develop a treatment that works, even though you don't really know exactly what it is, then who cares?
Yeah, I guess the brain is a beautifully complex box. And dyspraxia is something that's going on or not going on in the brain. Mm. And so because we don't have perfect understanding, I mean, to step sideways for a minute, when I did my undergraduate speech pathology degree, we didn't know about the pathways that are so important between, say, the subcortex and the frontal lobe. Mm. All of those connections that actually are where language happens, as much as the lobes and, you know, Broca's area and so forth. Mm. All of that, we didn't know that, but we had some effective treatments for aphasia, and we've been developing better treatments for aphasia all the way along. And we're still not there, but we didn't know that, and that didn't mean that we didn't treat aphasia.
Yeah.
There was knowledge that we didn't know. That's a bit complicated, but
Donald Rumsfeld style.
Yeah, Rumsfeld style. Don't we wish for those days? So with dyspraxia, it's the same thing. You know, we know some things. So we know that it's a problem with motor planning or programming, and the adult literature puts programming and then planning, and the pediatric literature puts planning then programming. But in essence, once you've decided what you want to do and you've filled out your phonology for it, you've got to give a set of motor instructions that are timing and prosody specific. Mm. So you've got to get your co-articulation sorted out, and you've got to send those instructions to your articulators. Now, the sending part is if you have a breakdown there, it's dysarthria. Mm. If you have a breakdown with choosing the sounds, it's phonology. And a breakdown in between choosing the sounds and writing the instructions is some kind of apraxia. So either you don't have the stored plan, or you can't, which is what happens in kids, or you can't access the plan, or you can't access it well, which is what happens in adults with an acquired apraxia. So if that set of instructions isn't there, you get all of the sequelae, to use a complex sort of term, you get all the follow-on things. So in kids, you get kids who can't put syllables together. In adults, you get people who are perpetually sort of in knowing what they want to say and not being able to say it. You know, they're blocked. Or they get stuck because the same motor plan keeps repeating. And so, you know, if we know that it's about planning and making a plan, then we should be able to make treatments that help people improve their planning skills. And that's basically what it comes down to.
Hmm.
Any treatment for an acquired or a developmental apraxia has got to help the person access their stored plans, store their plans better, and make new plans when they want to say something they've never said before.
Now, back to theory, you were just talking then about planning and programming. Do you separate those out?
I do.
Yeah, I do too.
The plan is the
gross kind of big picture.
If you take motor learning sort of ideas into account, sort of Schmidt's thing, so for anyone who doesn't know, Schmidt is the motor learning guru, but it's all about, his stuff is all about limbs and...
Which most of it is about, yeah.
But if you take his, you've got a general motor plan, and I think of that as the planning piece. So how do you say an S in general?
Mm.
And we know that individual words, it'll vary, and then you're going to vary it with rate and what the actual message needs to be and how confident you are and all the emotional overlays. So you've got your general motor plan. how to say NES, and then you have to modify that. You have to use parameterization, which is another sort of principles of motor learning concept, to modify that for the specific context. And so I think of planning as that general motor plan and programming as the parameterization. So speech pathologists talk about planning and programming. Motor learning theorists talk about the GMP and the parameters. For me, they're sort of synonyms. But the parameterization is when you go faster or slower or you change the word context. So we know that the vowel preceding a nasal is nasalized, but that's part of the parameterization, the co-articulation components.
Yep. Another way of it, and I don't know if you agree with this, but another way it's said to look at it is the motor plan is just the general sort of, like you say, almost the general sort of blueprint for a sound or something like that, whereas the program is more those very subtle and intricate changes in things like force, duration, co-articulation, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yes.
So I definitely separate them out, but I've seen some authors that don't sort of say, you know, planning / programming, or they have it as the one kind of thing. Even just thinking about the errors that people make, I think they're different.
Yeah, and I think the thing is that a plan can be stored for a word or a sentence or even a prayer. I mean, there's the classic examples of elderly priests who have a stroke, have apraxia, but they can still say mass because they've said those at hours worth of speaking so many times. They might not be able to give a sermon or do a Bible reading, but the components that are ritualized can be repeated because the motor plan is so well developed. So the plan might be, I mean, for any word that we have, I tell this story and it's about my sister. Mm. So when she was an undergraduate, she worked at Westpac and she answered the phone. She'd hear a beep in her ear and she would have to say, "Westpac, your merchant number, please." Mm-hmm. We were sitting at dinner one day and she burped. And instead of saying, "Pardon me," or whatever, she said, "Westpac, your merchant because that whole thing was stored as one plan. Yep. And she could vary, you know, how pleasant it sounded or how fast it came out.
Or
but
the accent or
stimulus response, it was so behaviourist that whole motor plan came out all at once.
Mm. It reminds me a bit about swallowing and, you know, how we arbitrarily divide it into these stages, but really it's one motor plan, really. And then the program depends on the bolus and how thirsty you are and whether you like the food and all that kind of stuff and your posture and
Yeah, exactly. And you know, we talk about swallowing being ballistic, but speech is ballistic as well. You know, once started, it's hard to stop it. And you can hear yourself making a misspeak. No, it's coming. It comes out anyway, and then you have to fix it.
Mm.
You know, that's, again, the plan. I mean, the feedback loops are important, and we know in both acquired and developmental apraxia, if you have an interference in the feed forward and feedback loops, you will end up with worse apraxia than if you just can't access the plan. And I think we over time will work out subgroups of certainly of the childhood apraxia, we'll work out subgroups. There are some children who can make a plan but can't store it, so they're forever making everything from new, which is, you know, that feed forward sort of thing.
Yep.
There are some kids who can't judge their own errors, so that's the feedback kind of thing. Children who just can't access what they've already stored or can't change it. I had a client once who was like 7 or 8, he really wanted to be able to say McDonald's and he said McGonald's instead. And he couldn't change McGonald's to McDonald's, even though he could do a D. He could do McDonald's. He could do the components. But when you put it all together, the old plan of McDonald's was so strong. The priming on that was so strong that it just overflew everything else. So I ended up teaching him how to say Macca's.
You go for substitution.
Instead of correction.
You go for compensation instead.
Yeah,
look, it's when I was a student, I had a client, a paediatric client who had dyspraxia, but really I was just sort of doing the Nuffield program because that was what I was told to do. But you've been developing and researching this approach called REST, haven't you?
Yeah.
You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, okay. So, 10 years ago, it's 10 years now that we've been working on REST. Myself and Kiri Ballard and Don Robin, who's an American researcher, had a conversation. I was like, I want to develop a better treatment for kids with apraxia. I'd really like to, you know, we now know at that stage we sort of come to the conclusion that childhood apraxia of speech was a problem of motor planning. And so I said, well, let's do all the things we can do to make for better planning. And Don said, well, I do this thing clinically. Why don't you test it? And so that's how REST started. He had a clinical idea and I had a drive to do something that was really theoretically sound, because nothing that was around at the time appeared to have been created from scratch to deal with the problem. So, yeah, so it started from there. And the first study has never been published because we got the kids in that study to change the change how they said nonsense words in the treatment, but it didn't carry over, so we didn't have a treatment effect. But we did get them to change how they, without treating them, they changed how they said real words. By treating the nonsense words that are part of REST, we got them to change the real words. Anyway, lots of trial and error, and now we've, you know, we've got to the point where hopefully in the next 6 weeks, 8 weeks, we'll have a website with video which shows people how to do the treatment. Yeah, so we've sort of gone from theoretical drive and clinical good idea together to two randomized control trials and a website. But it's been very slow. So I should say the idea of using the nonsense words, and clinicians find it difficult and parents find it difficult to understand the nonsense words. So we use nonsense words where the child can say all the individual sounds in the nonsense word, but they can't necessarily
put them together.
And so we do two or three, we have done four syllable nonsense words that are made up of sounds they can say, and we require them to get the prosody right and the sounds right. So we break prosody up into two parts, into the beats, which is the stress pattern, and into being smooth. Because one of the main features of kids with apraxia in particular is that they are halting or staccato. So we're trying to get them to speak smoothly, not in a stuttering way, but to speak smoothly and to get the prosody right and to get the phonemes right. And if they can get all of those things right, their intelligibility improves dramatically. Anyway, we chose nonsense words because certainly over the first few sessions, every time the child says or attempts to say the nonsense word, they're making a new motor plan. So we're really pushing the planning system and making the planning system do something that it's never done before, and that is just each session between 100 and 120 productions of a brand new thing it's never done before. And it works. Now, the evidence-based practice researcher in me says, yes, but nobody else has independently shown it works. So I do want the listener to know that although we've done lots of studies, two randomized control trials, et cetera, et cetera, somebody needs to do some replication for me. But so far, so good.
And I guess it removed the nonsense words to, I guess, remove like what happened with your sister. You're not going to have that happen with a nonsense word.
Exactly. So the nonsense words takes out any of the linguistic factors. It takes out any previous learning, any stored motor plans, and we're just doing the in real-time planning. And the most amazing thing about this is even kids who don't do very well in the treatment do have their day-to-day speech improves. So we've measured both their production of real polysyllabic words, so three or more syllable words. Do they improve on those? And they all do. One child in the last 10 years hasn't. And the other thing is we've measured, do they improve on sentences and in connected speech in conversation? And they do. And the parents spontaneously tell us that they've improved in all of these things. You know, they went to Christmas and grandma could understand them. And so there's a lot of that anecdotal but clinically really relevant information there too.
And there's a lot of emphasis on the prosody side of it, isn't there?
If the child could do the prosody and not do the phonemes, then they probably wouldn't get a diagnosis of apraxia.
But it's not just about saying something like, or for example, for a real word like hospital, it's like saying it hospital or something like, or hospital,
As a general rule, what I treat and teach and what the research says is that you shouldn't segment like that. You shouldn't model segmentation for any longer than you absolutely need to. And you certainly shouldn't teach people to segment.
Yeah. Do you think this has any role in treatment for adults with acquired dyspraxia?
Oh, absolutely. But we haven't tested it. I think Kiri Ballard, who's one of my collaborators, has got one client she's tested. We've used it with adolescents. And we've used it with one adolescent who'd had an acquired apraxia from brain surgery. So we haven't got any publications with adults, but I have a very strong feeling that the making a new plan and not relying on, you know, when you work with adults with apraxia, they're very frustrated because they know they used to be able to say that particular word and they can't say it anymore. And while you don't see very many pure apraxias that don't have aphasia attached, those people are even more frustrated than the people who have the combination of aphasia and apraxia. So if you can help them get around, like improve their planning skills without reference to the stored forms that they can't access, my gut feeling is that that should likewise improve. But I'd be grateful if anybody wanted to have a go clinically and, you know, work with me, or, you know, wanted to do a research degree and do it a bit more formally. But
yeah, and like you say, it's getting back to the theory side of things, I sometimes, or it's a challenge for me to actually be confident in my diagnosis sometimes with adults, because the way they're speaking could be a verbal dyspraxia, it could be a combination of some phonemic paraphasias, an ataxic dysarthria, a neurogenic disfluency, and sometimes trying to actually pinpoint what exactly it is almost impossible.
Yeah. Although, you know, like a trial of some treatment would be a bad thing. I think in the neurogenic disfluency, my PhD was on the effects of HIV on communication skills in adults, so completely different field. Still motor speech in the end. I didn't know it was going to be motor speech, but, you know, that's what it was.
Fate.
And I have a feeling that there's some older research that says that the areas of the brain in acquired apraxia and acquired dysfluency are overlapping. And so if we think that dysfluency and apraxia, or stuttering and apraxia if you want, are potentially different manifestations of a similar
underlying problem.
And I would throw cluttering in there as well. Then perhaps rest as a treatment, you know, it's worth exploring whether rest as a treatment would work for acquired dysfluency and for cluttering, because we don't have effective treatments for any of those.
And like you say, when you throw in an aphasia with it, then, it's a challenge to try and I guess, I don't know what you've done treatment intensity-wise with your studies, but, you know, it's all of those issues too about the dose.
Yeah, so we're playing with dose at the moment. Donna Thomas, who's one of my PhD students, her PhD is all about dose in rest and service delivery. So most of the research we've done has been an hour session, 4 days a week for 3 weeks, so 12 sessions, 1,200 trials, like 1,200 attempts at the nonsense words. So it's reasonably high intensity, particularly high for kids, but if you were an adult inpatient, perhaps not quite so bad, because you might be getting therapy or able to do therapy that often. Once you know what you're doing, you only need a therapy aid. You wouldn't need an experienced clinician to do the treatment with you once you knew what you were doing. So Donna looked at twice a week, so that's two sessions of an hour once a week, and we found that that intensity had very similar outcomes. The improvement in real speech was not quite as good, but overall it was certainly much better than no treatment. And then we did telehealth delivery of rest, and you might think speech intervention on telehealth isn't so good, but the research is actually starting to show lots of telehealth for speech and voice is fine, even with, you know, the limitations of various microphones and broadband and so forth. Anyway, so the telehealth had absolutely equivalent results to the face-to-face therapy.
Oh, yeah, they've looked at telehealth for fluency and LSVT and lots of other, even dysphagia. So it's definitely a thing. You just got to get the hardware and software and all that, and like you say, the broadband and all that kind of stuff to make it work.
Yeah, so that's sort of been quite good. You know, you could probably, it'd be irritating, but you could probably do it on the telephone. You'd have to sort of email out the stimulus and have them turn the stimulus cards over, sort of thing. But you could probably do it by phone. The only thing that hasn't worked has been parent training. So one of my other PhD students has looked at service delivery choices that clinicians make when resources are tight, so that's Jackie Lim, and clinicians go, you know, one of their main go-tos is train somebody else to do the therapy. About the same time she was doing that, Donna was running a parent training module to see if we could get parents to do it. And of the five children in the parent study, only three of them improved, and only one of them improved to the same amount as the other studies.
Interesting, isn't it?
So that's a no at this point.
So when did you sort of realise that speech was your thing?
Speech as a profession or speech as a subspecialty?
I just realised that both.
Okay, so, well, this sort of goes to your other set of questions. I was in high school, the careers advisor suggested OT or nursing, and neither of them really floated my boat, so I went to uni and started a science degree, thinking I'd do, I have no idea. It was just sort of a place market, really. I had no idea what I was going to do. And did very badly. They got excluded and I had lots of extenuating circumstances, personal stuff going on. I could easily have, you know, put up a case and would not have been excluded. But I just went, oh, okay, well, I'm clearly not meant to be here and, you know, life's tough. I don't have time to deal with this. So I went and got a job and joined the public service. Anyway, I ended up working in a employment and rehabilitation department, and we had a work experience girl come who was severely hearing impaired, and she had been through an oral
rehab
and it hadn't worked. So she had no sign and her speech was unintelligible and she couldn't lip read very well, and her writing skills were terrible. I mean, the poor thing was just, anyway, it made me mad, and I was looking for a, you know, what am I going to do? I've got to go back to uni and do something. So I discovered speech pathology. God, the careers advisor wasn't far off, but she was an idiot.
Yeah, I can't really imagine you being a nurse.
You know, good at English, good at science. Yeah. So that's how I discovered the profession. And my first client in second year as an undergrad was a little boy with apraxia.
Oh, wow.
So I discovered pretty quickly that I had a really good ear for speech and for transcription and for, you know, just the nuances of speech impairment. So, you know, that's sort of been it ever since.
Wow. Okay. And so have you always sort of worked with that kind of population?
No, the first job out of uni was with hearing impaired kids, mm-hmm. which was what I really wanted.
Mm.
That was good. And then I've done general clinical work. I still have a small amount of private practice, which is mostly speech impairment, but I'll see people with stuttering or late talking kids and adults fluency.
Which is all speech, I reckon.
Yeah, I do accent modification. Mm. You know, the problem with being a very busy in my full-time job is I don't have time to do any preparation for my load that is the extra. So I need to limit myself to things that I can manage within the time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing I'm finding too. It's just I could, you know, spend 1 hour with a client during the day or an hour driving to them, an hour with them, an hour driving back, and the rest of the time writing notes and doing preparation and all those sorts of things. When the stats come down to it, I've done an hour with one person a day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's
Yeah, so I don't do home or school visits. I'll have email conversations with people or phone calls with people, but I try to limit them to a very narrow window every week. You know, I only write a report if you pay for it.
Mm.
So your assessment gets you a one pager, which is here I'm I'm not allowed to say I'm an expert. Here is my years of experience and publications in this field being and being an acknowledged, and I'm putting air quotes here, expert, which we're not to say. yeah, there's a soapbox there.
Yeah.
Here's the summary. And if you want a report, you can pay for my time.
Yeah.
So that's how I manage the time to try and do that and, you know, not eat into the time the university's paying for.
Yeah, yeah. I'm finding the opposite at the moment. I'm only working 4 days a week as a clinician, but I'm still doing some casual stuff for La Trobe, so I'm trying to not have my university stuff eat into my main health time, which is, it's always a juggling act for everyone, I think.
Yeah.
So speaking of soapboxes, what is it about the profession at the moment that excites you or it's niggling at you or something you're very happy about or would like to see change?
Just one thing?
No, go for it. We got all day.
Well, let me just quickly go back to that expert thing. The association's code of ethics currently says you can't say you're an expert. Mm. Even if everybody else would call you an expert and you've got publications and grants and people come to you for second opinion and all those other things
and
that might
teach
be
it. Mm.
And I teach it. I can't say I'm an expert. The reason for this is sound in that anyway, I could say I was an expert in autism. Now, anyone who knew me would know that that was a complete lie.
Mm.
But I could, because there's nothing stopping me hanging up my shingle to say that.
Well, there's nothing stopping anyone hanging up a shingle to say they're a speech pathologist.
Well, there is that as well.
Hmm.
So I understand where the association's coming from, but there has to be a change because it is ridiculous that I cannot say I'm an expert in speech sound disorders. That's what the university pays me a lot of money for. That's what from time to time the association pays me a lot of money for.
Mm.
I mean, if their own, you know, you are a speaker at CPD isn't enough to say, well, you must have something going for you.
Yeah, you think there must be some criteria they could have in which you could say if you meet these conditions and you can call yourself an expert.
Yes, yes. And I know they're working on it, but it's mildly irritating.
Well, I acknowledge your expertise, Tricia.
Thank you.
It's a thing.
Yes, but to be positive, I think there are so many potential exciting things just around the corner that I can't even imagine, but technology is making such a big difference. Do you know about the Vocal ID project in the US?
Yes, I have been recording my voice.
Oh, aren't you a good person?
I haven't finished it yet because it takes ages. I haven't done it for months and months, but I have started.
So for the listeners who don't know, Rupal Patel, who is actually a motor speech researcher, has started up a not-for-profit where they can synthesize a voice for someone who has who is going to lose or who has never had
yep.
their own voice.
So, say people with cerebral palsy, motor neuron disease.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and so they're doing things like if you have motor neuron disease, you can record your own voice and then have it play through your alternative augmentative communication system. So, but if you're a child, there's a lovely video example available. A child who's never had her own voice, they're recording her sister's voice and then modifying it by filtering in some other similar age children. And so she will sound different to her sister, but she will sound like she is her sister's sister.
Yeah, and they can even use things like children who might only have sort of undifferentiated vowels. They can use that sort of basis. It's not to merge in with a donated voice, so it sort of has some characteristics of that child's resonance. And
And this is then, you know, I know they've just paired up with Minspeak, so they're pairing up with all the technology companies so that when you type in or use your eye gaze pointer or whatever to choose what you want to say, it comes out sounding like you.
I've started recording mine, but like I said, I haven't done it for a long time. That's actually really fascinating. They put up a phrase or a sentence on the screen. You say it back, or you say it, and it's recorded, and you can play it back. And they ask you lots of information about yourself, like your age, your gender, where you're from, how you would describe, or how you or other people would describe your speech. And yes, so what they're hoping to do eventually is if they have a woman from, you know, Melbourne who's in her mid-40s who's got motor neuron disease and needs a voice, maybe they can use mine.
And they'll modify it so that it doesn't sound like you.
Yeah.
But it sounds like someone who's in their mid-40s from Melbourne.
Yeah. So at least to start with, it's female and Australian and age specific.
Age matched, yes.
So that's a huge leap already.
Yeah, so, I mean, that is really exciting. And I had to give a sort of, you know, what is speech pathology talk yesterday. And I said, well, you know, listen to Stephen Hawking's voice. That is the voice he had when he got the device.
Yeah.
And his devices have upgraded, but they've stuck with that voice because he's known internationally by his voice. Even though it's, you know, tinny 1980s voice, it's still him. So, you know, talking about identity and voice and so forth, but those ideas, those capacities, and in terms of treatment, you know, automation of treatment, I'm not scared of.
No.
I think that then makes us, you know, diagnosticians, problem solvers, planners.
I was going to say, you still need someone to do the assessment and the accurate diagnosis to know what treatment to prescribe and how much and how often and review it and all that kind of stuff and probably program it as well to a degree.
Yeah.
So, look, if someone else can do that and I can spend more time, you know, assessing people and giving them treatment to do, then go for it.
So I'm not scared of those things. Some people are worried about giving that up, but I think,
you know, you're just modifying how you do it.
And that, you know, we're always talking about shortages of services and how do we deliver more with less. You know, this is a fabulous opportunity. The other thing I'm just, so we've done negative, positive, just the other thing I want to say is I'm frustrated by how slow change is generally in the profession.
Yeah.
The guy who invented the Hannon program once said that it takes between 10 and 15 years for a good idea to move from research to practice. And it may be that. Medicine has the same sort of number. But that frustrates me because that's patients and clients and families who are missing out on better. I guess it's that client focus. How can we be better without wearing ourselves out or, you know, just working stupid hours or anything? If there's a better way of doing something, the resistance to better is in the profession, the conservatism in the profession frustrates me.
I also think it's a little bit about, and nothing wrong with evidence-based practice, I'm all for it, but that question of how much evidence is enough.
Mm.
And, you know, Rosenbeck's a big one on saying, you know, we don't have to wait for the randomised controlled trial. You know, if there's a few N1 studies that suggest something might be helpful, then try it with your client.
Mm. And keep good data.
Yeah, exactly. So contribute to the data. And so I think, too, there's some, I don't know, I just get some sort of feeling that the pendulum always swings. And, you know, we've sort of gone from, like you say, anecdotal, like you're saying at the start, like, why do we do it like that? And if it's just because our supervisor did, well, that's not a good enough reason. But also you don't need to wait for 10 randomised controlled trials to try something with a client, you know.
No, but somewhere in the middle.
And yeah. That EBP3 stuff about that it's the research, it's clinical expertise and knowledge and informed choice for the client. And I think that's important to remember those three components.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the pendulum, certainly in the UK, they're talking about N of one studies being the highest level of evidence because they don't wash out any of the detail. Mm. It's very interesting. When I talk to my American colleagues, as a researcher, I'm mostly do treatment research. Mm. And whether that's does this treatment work or, you know,
how much do we need?
Which treatment is better or how much do we need or what are clinicians doing in terms of treatment? That's the sort of things I do. So, you know, what should we do? What is the evidence? So we do a systematic review. What do clinicians do? So we do a survey. Are families happy with that? So that's a different survey or interviews. But they're all about treatment. And when I talk to my American research colleagues, they are tied up with a thing called tenure,
yes.
Which is getting a permanent job tyranny at a university. And it's not an issue in Australia because although academics have academic freedom, that's just you're allowed to have an opinion without losing your job.
Most
of us. But most academics are on contracts that are just like most health employees.
Yep.
There's conditions for how, you know, what happens if they want to make you redundant or sack you or whatever, and you have to give notice, and it's the same as other people who are employed by large organisations. But in the States, they've got to earn that, and until they do that, they're casual.
Yep.
And they put in an enormous effort. And, you know, people were prepared to do treatment research until confident of tenure.
Yep.
Because it took too long.
Do you feel like, particularly in that case, there's sort of like a temptation to, with this pressure to publish, to do research that's quicker and easier so you can get the publications? Because treatment research, like you said, you've been at it for 10 years with this one technique, and there's still lots of stuff that you need to work on in terms of, like you say, dose and different service delivery models and those and generalisation and those sorts of things. So I remember that as an academic sort of feeling like, well, if I've got the choice between doing this project that's going to be hard and long and not have any papers for a while, or this one which I could do in 12 months and get a paper out, I'll choose that one.
Yeah, well, I guess you've got to, if you're being strategic, and truthfully, I only know this in retrospect, I didn't know this at the time, you have little projects that are quick and easy to do as one stream, and then you have slow and, you know, developmentally incremental as the other stream. Mm. So you need to have those publications every year as an academic. Mm. And maybe, you know, maybe you get lucky, but maybe you don't with the treatment research. As I said, you know, that first study never been published. Mm. So that's 8 clients' data. I can't get it published.
Yeah.
You know, we just use that as a stepping stone.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, you're doing other things. Mm. That's fine for me because I've got an ongoing academic job.
Yeah. And you've been at it for a while.
Yeah. I've only been a proper academic for 10 years. So
proper academic.
Pretty much the proper academic. Well, before that I was a clinical educator and not an academic for a number of years. And then I was the manager of our on-campus clinic. Until 2007, I was the manager of our on-campus clinic. And although I had an academic appointment, I wasn't expected to produce research. So if you started the clock from 2007, that would be fair. Mm. The university doesn't, of course. No. They start from the very beginning.
But having that, like you said, your collaborators and things around you is very important.
Yeah, and having... This is the same whether you're a clinician or a researcher. You've got to give a little to get a little. Mm. And, you know, if I say, yes, I'm happy to help you, then that other person is likely to say, yes, they're going to help me. Yeah. So, it, you know, this is philosophical sort of thing, but people say to me, why are you, you know, why do you go and do this or that? Well, there's two things that are driving me. One is I want to do more about being better at doing what we do as a profession so that our clients have improved opportunities and so that we don't burn out and so that the frustrations are dealt with. So there's that professional drive. And then the second is I said this to our dean a while ago, I prosper if we all prosper. So if the team around me, whether they're over or under me, are doing well, then I will do well.
Yeah.
Now, that might not always be true, but actually it seems to be true most of the time.
Yeah, you can't function in isolation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. So given your vast experience in clinical education and in academia, any advice for speech students out there or new speech pathologists?
For the students, I think... it's okay to wobble, and people who know me will know I'm very big on using metaphors to explain things. When you learn to ride a bike, the only way you can learn to ride a bike is if you deal with the wobble. Mm. If every time you start to wobble, you put your feet down, you're not riding your bike. Mm. And your clinical educator's job is to let you wobble enough so that you learn to balance on your own. And every time you go to a new placement, there is some wobble, some feeling of discomfort from some not being sure.
Feeling a bit unsafe.
A bit unsafe. That's okay. The first time you ride without your family, the first time you ride down a hill, when you change bikes, you know, all of these things, when you ride on a highway for the first time, or, you know, it doesn't matter how good you are as a cyclist, there's going to be some new challenge for you. The first time you ride a mountain bike and you go over some rough terrain.
A bit like your motor program.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is. That's a motor program, but it's also proprioception and a whole lot of other adjustments, sensory inputs as well. But
I guess that same thing about you may have feel like you've got some general kind of big picture skills, but every situation you're in is going to change and challenge you in a different way.
Yeah, and the child who learns to who gets on a bike and isn't scared of anything and doesn't wobble is probably going to fall off and hurt themselves. And we'll have to learn from the falling off. So don't be, I guess my advice to the students is don't be worried about being anxious. Know that it's part of the process. Yep. Live through it and come out the other side. And somebody once, I was about to do my first ever international presentation, and somebody once reminded me at that point when I was very nervous, remember that physiologically your brain can't tell the difference between excitement and fear. And so if what you think is excitement, you know, you'll look forward to it. But if you're interpreting that as fear, then you won't. So every time you've got the sweaty palms, you're excited.
Yeah, and I think it's just really important to normalise those feelings, because they are totally normal, that feeling of, you know, and you and I still get it sometimes with clients or teaching or research or whatever it is, that, you know, you're doing something new or challenging or you're unsure of yourself, and it is totally natural to feel anxious or a bit scared or worried or nervous, and that's because you're human, and feel it and carry on.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It's the, you know, the lots of students feel it and run away from it. Like, it's like, no, it's okay
or
to feel like.
Or the vicious circle, you get anxious because you're feeling anxious. It's like, no, you're feeling anxious. It's like the, yep, it's a cloud and it's going to float by and, you know, everyone's still alive. It does take practice.
So in terms of advice for, that's my advice for students. Mm. And probably that would stand for all of us. And in terms of new graduates, say yes.
Mm.
People give you an opportunity. They say, do you want to be involved in this? Say yes, because you don't know where it's going to lead you. And if I hadn't said yes, I wouldn't have ended up where I am here.
Yep.
Chris Code, who was a professor when I was a new clinical educator, said, why aren't you doing a PhD? And I said, because I need an income. He said, I'll find you a scholarship.
Mm.
And he did.
Mm.
So I still had to apply for it and whatever, and then I still had to do the PhD. It wasn't easy or anything. But his point, you know, he made an opportunity. That's great, and that's part of his job as a professor. But my saying yes, you know, led to my career.
Yes, yeah. No, it's a good point. Say yes, but also just know when you've said yes enough.
Oh, yes. Don't say yes to new and interesting things, but you've got to follow through.
Yep. And even if you're doing enough or you feel like you're on the brink of doing too much and someone offers you something, you can say no, but you can always say, but in 6 months' time or next year or something, I'd still be interested in helping out with that. So because, you know, another opportunity might come up.
Yeah. The other way of dealing with that is take stock and think, well, again, our dean said to me, why are you ticking that box twice? So if you've done something for a little while and demonstrated that you're competent and so forth, then maybe it's time to swap that for this new and interesting thing.
Yeah.
So I think at that time I'd been on Speech Pathology Australia New South Wales branch for 5 years. Mm. And she said, why are you still doing that? You've shown that you're competent. You've shown that you can do it. You've made a difference. You know, move aside, let somebody else have that opportunity.
Yeah,
and that's a good point. That then gives you space to do something else.
Yeah, that old analogy of I use with my patients but also with students and things about, you know, you can only hold so many pencils in your hand and if you want to pick up a new one, you've got to put one down.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly.
Just, yeah, you can't just keep picking stuff up because it's in the end you'll just drop everything.
Mm. Yeah. Or you'll poke your eye out.
Yeah, one of those things.
Too busy trying to hold pencils.
That's right. So have you got any particular projects or websites or anything that you want to promote while you're on air, so to speak?
I don't have the website yet, but we are about to have, as I said, we're about to launch, if I can finish writing the content, the website that explains how to do REST.
Mm-hmm.
And there's beautiful professional videos that we've made to go there.
Mm-hmm.
So if anyone's interested in learning more about REST, as we were talking about earlier, if they just Google me, if you Google me, I come up first. So you'll find
them. Do they Google Patricia McCabe?
Either.
Okay.
Or Patricia or Patricia. Mm-hmm. You just got to spell both names correctly.
Okay. I'll put a link up on the blog site. And I can put up your Twitter handle as well?
Of course.
Yep. Good-o.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anything else you wanted to say?
I think I've covered everything that was sort of, you know.
Pertinent.
Pertinent.
Well, in that case, it's assessment time then.
Okay. All right.
Rainbow Passage or Grandfather Passage?
North Wind.
Ooh, what's North Wind?
The North Wind?
Hmm.
It's an alternate. I'm giving you a, I'm being a bit provocative here. So the North Wind is a newer passage, and just because I'm bored with the Rainbow Passage and the Grandfather Passage just makes people laugh.
I've never liked the Grandfather Passage.
Yeah, so the Grandfather Passage makes people laugh, so you can't use it. The Rainbow Passage is fine, and we use it a lot in research, but there's the North Wind, and there's another one which I've forgotten. But anyway, I just encourage people to have a look at the North Wind and I will send you the link which you can then put up.
Great. Okay. So do you know the Rainbow Passage off by heart?
When sunlight strikes raindrops in the air. They form a prism of white light.
Act like a prism and form a rainbow, isn't it?
Yes. There's white lights in there as well. Form a rainbow. These take the shape of a long round arch.
With its two ends apparently beyond the horizon. With its path high above.
Half high above, and its two ends apparently
beyond the horizon. Yeah, anyway.
People say there's a pot of gold at the end. At
one end, but no one ever finds it.
Finds it. You can look and no one ever finds it.
When a man or someone looks for
something... Yeah, no, when a man looks for something beyond his reach,
his friends say he's looking for a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. There we go.
Yes, and I would say today I had glottal fry as I was saying it.
Yeah. it's like the Bert Thompson paragraph from the Mount Wilga. I pretty much know that one off by heart. Bert Thompson of Brisbane had a – was it? Bert Thompson of Brisbane had a small plane. It had a large gas tank but no radio.
I can do some of the grandfather passage.
Something about a black frock coat.
You know about my grandfather. He wears a long black frock coat.
Something about buttons.
Yeah.
And anyway, I can banana oil.
Yeah.
Yada 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 buttons. Yada 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 banana oil.
Okay, that was the trick question.
No, that's about all I had to ask about assessment. Really. Do you follow the footy at all?
I do.
Who do you barrack for?
Well, in the AFL, it's Swans, mm-hmm. and in the NRL, it's the Sharks, Cronulla Sharks. Oh, so great. I'm a very happy camper.
And are you a cricket tragic like me?
I am, you know that.
Oh, no, that's what I just thought of us.
You're keeping me from the cricket, of course.
Oh, you're keeping me from the cricket. I'm still on leave. I could be sitting watching it right now, but I'm talking to you. That's how important you are.
And every time I'm in Sydney and the test is the cricket test in Sydney is on at the moment, and every time it starts to drizzle, I quickly look at the radar to see if it's going that way or not.
Dance or dance?
Dance.
Yeah, I think it's on dance as well. And any TV or internet shows you're particularly interested in?
Not visually, but I'm really into podcasts at the moment.
Yeah, I'm a huge podcast fan.
And there's a couple that I really like. The Allusionist, that's with an A, but it is Allusionist. She's a British woman who does an American podcast. It's half an hour a week, and it's fabulous.
Mm, okay.
She did an episode a while ago where she interviewed a linguist who wanted to date on an internet dating site. And so the linguist analysed all the language of the successful people she wrote her profile in the language that got the dates, and she got married.
Wow. Wow, that's huge.
I bet she got a paper out of it.
That's all that counts. Yeah, married, whatever. Did you get a paper? Did you publish?
Yeah, so The Illusionist. And the other one I'm really enjoying at the moment is Freakonomics, which is about economics. But in sort of everyday life.
Yeah.
And so they'll take some economics paper and turn it into, you know, whether you should follow what the supermarket says in how you go up and down the aisles.
Okay.
So what are the economic benefits of doing it the way the supermarket's designed it versus going the opposite direction?
I'm mostly into true crime kind of podcasts and The Minefield.
Oh, yes, I love The Minefield.
Yeah, whenever I'm doing a home visit, I always try and wing it so I'm in the car between 11:30 and 12 on a Thursday. the rest are usually just true crime ones.
Mm. Yeah, but the thing about The Minefield is that if you listen to the on-radio version, it's half an hour.
Yeah, but the podcast is an hour.
If you listen to the podcast, it's an hour.
You get extra, yeah. It's lots of food for thought in that one. All right, well, we might wrap it up, let you get back to the cricket while you're at work. And hopefully I'm sure they're all out by now. Has to have happened. And
Are the Australians?
No, the Pakistanis.
Oh, the Pakistanis are all out. The Australians didn't enforce the follow-on.
Oh, didn't they? Oh, when I left for lunch, though, I hadn't gone back after the rain delay, so I was just waiting for them to get the last couple out. Oh, okay.
Mm.
Well, it's been a good test series, actually, although I feel like the Pakistanis have given up a bit in this last one.
Mm.
But anyway, can't have it all. All right, well, thank you so much for talking to me. It's been a pleasure. And I'm glad we could get actually stuck into some meaty, speechy talk today about dyspraxia.
Okay, my pleasure. Mm.
And I'll put up, like I said, I'll put up some links to you at Sydney Uni and your Twitter handle, and people can contact you if they're interested in the rest stuff or anything else or all the rest.
Yes, in rest or all the rest, yes.
Cats, cricket, whatever. And, rabbits. I'm sure, rabbits, yes. Any kind of fluffies. Mm. And I'm sure I will see you around at a conference soon.
Yes. Lovely chatting.
And on Twitter.
Yes. All right.
Have a good weekend. See ya.
Thank you. You too. Bye.